I'd like to start off tonight with a story about a woman named Jenny, who was born to a middle-class family in Australia. They had two daughters. Parents were kind of middle-class, well-intentioned, if anything, maybe too indulgent with their children. The story goes that the older daughter was quite loyal, and Jenny was very free-spirited and fought with her parents a lot, challenged them a lot. And as she got into adolescence, she rebelled against the curfews, against the boundaries that were set, and the tensions built more and more. And her parents were upset with her friends. And she chafed more and more, you know, you can't control me. And with a fair bit of pre-thought, she one night went into her parents' bedroom and rifled through their wallets and took their cash, their credit cards, the bank books, and left. And early that morning, went to the bank and forged her mother's signature from their savings account and used the credit cards for some cash advances and went to a city in Australia where she thought her parents would never look for her. As you can imagine, her parents were distraught. They contacted the police. They put flyers everywhere they thought she might be. And as she started her new life, she had all kinds of cash. She had plenty of friends who were attracted to her and her newfound wealth. And relatively quickly, she started to run out of money. And she started using drugs and eventually found herself living on the streets. And without any money, turned to prostitution, found herself addicted. And over the course of the next couple of years, she at one time was walking down the street and saw a poster of her face from many years ago saying, "Have you seen this girl? And call this number." And she tore it down but folded it up and kept it. After a while, as she got more and more ill, she had a sickness that didn't go away, and she found out it was hepatitis C, and she could no longer find any way to get by. So as the story goes, kind of out of desperation, she found some money to take a train to another part of the country where she might get some medical help and start over, but she left her parents a message saying that she'd be taking a train. And she was going to be stopping by this train station. And if they were there, she would love to say hello. But if they weren't there, she totally understood. And she'd continue on her way. After she left the message, she had all kinds of second and third and fourth doubts. You know, why did I call? They won't be there. Tremendous shame, as you might imagine. When she got to the train station, it was at night, and she stepped out, and she looked down to her left. There was no one there. She looked to her right, and there was her family. Her parents, her sister, her aunts and uncles, wearing party hats with the welcome home sign, and her parents running toward her with tears in her eyes. And I tell that story, which is really a variation of many stories of the prodigal daughter or the prodigal son, because I'd like to talk tonight about what it means to come home with all the parts that are broken off as we go through life. Is it possible for you to welcome those parts with the same loving arms as in that story? I'd like to talk about homecoming, and particularly about one of the most transformational tools there is of your capacity to develop self-compassion. So there are four questions I'd like to explore tonight. The first is, how does this practice of concentration or intentional awareness serve in coming home? how can you access non-judging awareness? And how can you access compassion? What's the technology for finding your way to a visceral experience of compassion? And finally, a little bit about what it means to open to the two wings of this practice. So a little bit about the role of concentration. I'd like to share an experience with you from maybe about 10 years ago when I was on retreat. I was quite enamored with some of the stories about what's possible when you can sustain moment-to-moment awareness in the senses, the deeper states of concentration. So with a fair bit of will and excitement, I engaged into concentration practices. And choosing a technique, for me, the breath, when the mind wandered, to immediately bring it right back to the breath, back to that visceral experience of here and now. In this particular technique, I narrowed my attention more and more and more to just where I could just sense the breath at the just below the nostrils, kind of the breath outside the body. And I found over time, as challenging and as excruciating as that was, I found myself getting very, very calm. And I had an experience where, as I was just sitting very, very quietly, I just thought about my right hand. And I could feel, as I held my attention to my right hand, I could feel my right hand get warm. And then my right hand got hot. I thought, well, this is kind of cool. I wonder if I can do this with my left hand. So I flooded my awareness into my left hand. I could feel my left hand warming up. I thought, well, I wonder if I can switch it back. So I switched it back. I wonder if I can make one hand warm and one hand cool. I wonder if I can switch it back. And so as I was sort of lost in this game of moving energy around my body, I remembered an article I had read a long time ago about Swami Rama, who was the founder of the Himalayan Institute, one of the very first people to come from the East to be studied as to what he could do with the mind. And one of the mind-blowing things, I think it was written up in Life magazine, was he could make one hand warmer than the other and move it back and forth. And they couldn't understand how this could possibly be. So suddenly I thought, I'm doing what Swami Rama did. And I wanted to shake the person next to me, say, hey, I'm doing what Swami Rama did. And then suddenly I realized that, well, this was really interesting. It had nothing to do with liberation. It had nothing to do with non-judging awareness. It was a very, very powerful tool. And that was an important insight for me. Because I realized that for me, and I think for many of us, using concentration is a tool. It's a way of gathering your attention. There are many very concentrated people on the planet who are miserable because what they're missing is the mindfulness, the non-judging awareness. So I think it's helpful when we explore what it means to come home is that there is this very, very powerful tool available to you at any time, which is to call your attention back, to reabsorb your attention in the here and now. So I'd like to offer a little experiment which Hugh let us in last night. I found it to be very helpful. If you like, you can close your eyes, just very briefly. And I'm going to give you the instruction, and then you can just practice. If you would, let all of your attention be present to the next three breaths. And ask yourself, how intimately can I feel what is happening on the inside? And can you sense this quality of arriving and the awareness of what's here right now. And can you sense this quality of awareness? What does it mean to be aware of awareness right now? If you like, you can let your eyes open, or if you like, you can remain with them closed. The byproduct of concentration is a calming, a soothing. And it creates more awareness of what is here. And it helps to set the stage for non-judging awareness, for resting in presence, a very powerful tool. So as you become more aware of what's here, of what's really here, there is, of course, a myriad of experience that's possible in any given moment. And some of the reports I've heard today through the groups are sleepiness and restlessness, some anger, some lost in fantasy, lost in thought. For some, a sense of something emerging that they don't know quite what it is, but some quality of presence emerging. There's an analogy I love from Joseph Campbell, and I think it describes this practice so beautifully. If you can imagine a big circle, through the middle of the circle is a line. Above the line is what you're aware of. Below the line is what you're not aware of. And the line can move. And the line moves in direct relationship to your capacity to relax and pay attention. The more you relax and more you pay attention, the more you feel sensations you hadn't felt before. You might begin to notice repetitive thoughts, the thoughts that have come through maybe 5 or 10 times already. You might become more aware of predominant beliefs that are threading their way through your awareness. You might become aware of some of your habitual ways of reacting to what arises. And this, to me, is not just the magic, but the miracle of the practice. The more you relax, the more you pay attention, the more you feel, and the more you notice, the more naturally awake you become to what is here. And, as Hugh spoke to so beautifully, you become more aware of the attitude in your mind. You become more aware that you can actually shift your attitude to what your experience may be. Hugh also spoke of a little bit about what gets in the way of being present. When you focus on the here and now, of course, you become more and more intimately aware of how you're not here and not now. So the five hindrances, or the five obstacles, which were codified 2,500 years ago and are quite accurate today. And when I'm teaching in a corporation, I often describe them as the five ways you react when things aren't going your way. When you go through this little checklist, anyone experience aversion, anger, judgment, ill will, blame, perhaps? Today, perhaps, did you experience some form of craving, of finding yourself lost in fantasy or planning or lost in some sensual delight? Perhaps you found yourself carried away by the winds of worry, with restlessness, anxiety, being on that hamster wheel of just circular thought with no resolution to whatever issue might be churning through. Perhaps you were treated to the weather systems of sloth and torpor, of heaviness or sleepiness or fogginess or density. Or perhaps the weather system of doubt, the paralysis that occurs in doubt, or that ruthless self-critic that's right there. As I like to say, the good news is there are only five. The bad news is they are pervasive and nefarious. There are lots of other factors that are between you and being present. I love the lists in the system. There are the the worldly winds, the eight worldly winds. As we're trying to cultivate steadiness and equanimity through this life. We're being buffeted by winds all the time. They show up as certain fears, the fear of pain, the fear of loss, the fear of blame, and the fear of shame. They're also driven by certain desires, the desire for pleasure, the desire for gain, the desire for fame, and the desire for praise. And through all these things that are buffeting away at you all day long, there are three other qualities which pervade our experience, which block us from an experience of aliveness here and now. And these are oftentimes described as the three poisons of greed, of hatred, and delusion. When we are unconsciously caught in some form of reaching or grasping, or we're caught in some form of pushing away, of aversion, or we're caught in delusion. And delusion is simply believing something is true when it isn't actually true, or believing something isn't true, which actually is true. All of this is part of our technicolor experience when we practice. Every time you come back to the here and now, when you guide yourself back to the direct experience in your body, the aliveness of sensation, there is a rearriving, a resettling. And inevitably, you begin to notice what you hadn't noticed before. And perhaps you begin to experience as well moments of non-judging presence, moments of simply resting in a quality of being with nothing to do or nothing to improve and nothing to take away. With all these different qualities that take you away from the here and now, one of the elements, kind of the what grows out of all of these, is a very important thing to explore, I find. And that is the experience of judgment, when you're lost in judgment. Which brings the question of how do you access non-judging mind? The mind, of course, is generating thoughts all the time. Yesterday at lunch, I saw the vegetarian chili. And the next thing, I just saw the chili, and then I heard David Bowie's voice singing, and the meditators go, toot, 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 toot. Where did that come from? A good friend was describing his very first time on retreat. And as he was walking around, he noticed himself having these thoughts. And he thought, really, you're going to wear those pants to a retreat? No. Oh, nice haircut. And during walking meditation, of like, you're walking too fast. You're not being mindful. You're walking too slow. You're trying to be too spiritual. And then he realized, is this the world I'm living in? This world of non-stop judgment? Have you noticed your mind, either in self-judgment or judging your externals? Have you noticed how kind of out of control it can be? And have you judged yourself for judging? And that's when we get into the second arrow, where we experience some form of discomfort or dissatisfaction, and then we add more onto it. This judging mind is a mind of limited possibility. And it's put so well in a poem called Tiny Boxes. This mind is cluttered today. Words and images, harsh and relentless, searching for some explanation for the state of everything. In a world of tiny boxes, we are labeled and sorted by the color of our skin, the shape of our bodies, the sound of our language, the size of our bank account, the person we love, the God we believe in. Difference becomes deadly when it cannot reach beyond arbitrary walls that separate when we fail in our understanding that every heart beats the same. A judging mind locks you in. No possibilities. So what's the key? I think perhaps the most profound is the moment of recognizing the judging. As Tara said this morning, when you can recognize what's happening, when you can name it, it's like you put a frame around it. And when you recognize it, you've shifted your relationship to it. You are no longer judging, you are aware of judging. And there's a world of difference between judging and being aware of judging. The third Zen patriarch said, "To set up what you like against what you don't like is a disease of the mind. Make the slightest distinction between good and bad, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart." And as we move now into the belly of the retreat, as we develop more presence, more stillness, more concentration, what's between you and feeling free, what's between you and your true nature, will present itself. And inevitably, the judging mind is going to work its way into your body as a clench of some kind. It'll work its way into your thoughts. It'll work its way into your emotional body. Sometimes you can just recognize it and name it, and you've shifted your relationship to it. Sometimes you can make room for it, and it'll shift. It'll let go. It'll change like the weather. Sometimes it needs a little extra attention. If you were at the guided heart practice today with Tara, you explored the new and improved rendition of RAIN. I'd like to take a little time to acknowledge this practice and talk a little bit about how it can be a vehicle for compassion and for profoundly shifting your experience to whatever may be presenting. And I'd like to talk in particular about this challenge of accessing self-compassion. Each of us has to find our own way, to find our wiring to that. So in the practice of RAIN, if you're not familiar with it, the R stands for recognizing or realizing what's presenting. The A represents this quality of allowing or accepting what's here. And it's always important to point out, particularly at this time of the retreat, as you're getting more and more sensitized, as your intention to be more present and aware gets more vibrant and alive, that sometimes what arises in your experience, it may feel like it's too much. You may find that you can't allow it, or it doesn't feel safe to allow it or accept it. In that case, it's very, very helpful to let it know you see it, and let it know another time when the conditions are more supportive, to let it know you're willing and intentional to be with it. But shift your attention in some way. Just shift your attention to another anchor, or maybe take a break or get a cup of tea. Because sometimes what can arise in our practice can just feel like it's too much, and it can kick off an experience of both fear and helplessness that may not be so skillful. So a very skillful thing, if it doesn't feel safe, Another time, different conditions. The I part of this equation is investigation and being intimate. And as Tara said this afternoon, a lot of the guidance is to move from the story or your narrative to the experience, to where it lives on the inside. A number of body workers use this byline in their work. They say your issues are in your tissues. Any thought, any belief, any emotion, if you sense on the inside, you will find where it lives. Sometimes it's strong and unmistakable. The clench in your gut, the lump in your throat, the tears burning at the corners of your eyes. Sometimes it'll flicker or blip or flare. A feeling of sadness will arise, but it's gone. Quite often it's unformed, it's vague, it's amorphous. It's just below that line of what you're not aware of, because it's just coming into awareness. So what it requires, relax and pay attention. How intimately can you experience and feel what is right there? What is arising in your body-mind? The end to nourish with self-compassion, with what arises, to ask yourself, is it possible to hold this in some form of loving presence? If I were to offer this kindness, how does it move or shift or change? I'll talk a little bit more about some of the technology around that. And sometimes when we can do this, we'll begin to feel a shift. Something that felt tight and personal will begin to soften. Not only has it softened, but who you are as the experiencer has softened. You begin to realize that you are not the anger, you are the awareness of the anger. You are not the grief, you are the awareness of the grief. You are the space in which the grief arises. So I would like to share with you another story, again from a retreat I took years ago. I think it was actually maybe it had been the same retreat. I was at a time in my life where I was in a big transition. I had been in a leadership position in a big organization and was stepping down. And in all transitions like that, from kind of an executive level, it wasn't the smoothest process. And so there were some challenges along the way and some hurt along the way. Those who I thought were allies, I found out weren't allies, and my heart was hurting. And I knew I needed to take some time to be on retreat. So about 10 days into the retreat, I started developing this pain in my upper back. I've practiced and taught yoga for a couple decades, so I've got a lot of techniques for nuking pain. But it didn't work. I tried every yogic technique I knew. And I'd sit with it. It would get really chronic. I'd try to be still, and then I would move. And then it was like a chiropractic adjustment, just crack, crack, crack. And then it would settle. And within 30 seconds, the pain would start to build. This went on for 3 or 4 days, getting more and more intense. And again, I was trying everything I could. I met with my teacher, kind of describing what was going on. And he quite rightly challenged me. And he said, you know, maybe you're dealing with this superficially. I thought, moi? He said, have you tried just being with it? That hadn't occurred to me. And so I decided I was just going to be with this. So I had recognized what was going on. I hadn't been ready to accept it because I was fighting it. So I finally decided, I'm going to allow this. I actually said to myself, if I die of this, I'm going to sit here. I'm going to sit through this. And so then I turned to the practice of investigation. And I began to examine the sensations as intimately as I could. And I shifted to this practice of naming or noting. So as the pain would arise, red hot pain, waves of red hot pain, pulsing white hot pain, a one-pointed white hot pain. And I remember saying to myself, this feels like the point of a knife. This feels like I'm being stabbed in the back. Boom. And suddenly the depth of literally feeling stabbed in the back, the betrayal that I knew had happened but hadn't felt, was suddenly on full display. I then shifted to the end to nourish this as best I could. So I continued to name and to try to make room for what was there. The first was shock, making room, opening to shock. And then waves of anger, just pulsing anger without any form, just radiating anger, which then got specific into revenge. So the revenge played through. And then under the revenge, embarrassment. And under the embarrassment, getting really right down into it, a deep, deep sense of shame. I did my best to stay with it, to rest in presence, to offer it as much empathy and kindness as I could. And then, as Tara said earlier, as you nourish with self-compassion, you stay with yourself. And you sense what shifted, or what has shifted. So as I just sat with that, I felt this sense of ease. I felt like a major weather system had moved through my body-mind. And I stayed with it, mostly because the bell hadn't rung and there was nowhere to go. But then suddenly, I had a flood of understanding. And the understanding had to do with the person who had put that knife in my back. I suddenly was able to get his point of view. I got, on a cellular level, his fear, how terrified he was of losing his job, and how, yes, he threw me under the bus, but it came from a very, very deep, a deep-seated sense of like a survival fear on his part. And the forgiveness just started to flow. The empathy started to flow. In a way, I hesitate to share that story because it's a pretty dramatic story. It's one of the more dramatic experiences I've had in meditation. But when you ride that wave of recognizing, opening and allowing, and then leaning into your experience, of opening into the visceral aliveness of it and bringing in a sense of compassion, whether it be a small wave or a big wave, it is a powerful, powerful tool. The challenge, though, that I have found is how do you access self-compassion? For some of us, perhaps we have an easier way of going about it. For others of us, it's a little more challenging. Self-compassion, for many of us, has sort of been, we kind of lost our capacity a long time ago. So I wanted to say a little bit about it and offer some possibilities. This reminds me of a story on a retreat many years ago. We were talking about metta, about generating kindness. And there was an older man on the retreat who asked to meet with one of the teachers. He said he couldn't access metta. He didn't have any access to loving kindness. He was estranged from his family, estranged from his wife, his ex-wife, his kids. And he was very, very shut down. So they spent a long time combing through his life for his experience of where he felt a sense of loving kindness. And where they ended up was way back when he was a kid, in his neighborhood, there was a dog that he kind of liked. And that's where he started. So wherever you may be on the self-compassion meter, you start where you are. You nourish that. You nurture that. We are so quick to become paralyzed by judgment. So quick to be paralyzed by this ruthless critic. So on one end of the scale, I was working with a woman. And we were going through this process of recognizing, allowing, investigating. And she was exploring an issue tied in with her daughters. She was angry at her daughters. And she was able to kind of find a sense of like of really how her body was holding that experience, kind of a tightness in her chest and a clench in her belly. And I said, well, can you offer that some kindness? And she said, what do you mean? I said, what if you were just to offer it some compassion? And she said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, what if you were just to be friendly toward it? And she said, you mean not mind it being there? I said, yes, let's try that. And for her, that was her wiring. To not mind it being there gave it room. It gave it space to shift and move and flow. If you've practiced with Tara, you're familiar with her invitation to bring your hand to your heart or to bring your hand to your cheek. There's something very powerful about that practice because it's somatic, it's embodied. And it can help you, perhaps, to access the possibility of offering self-compassion and self-nourishing. Thich Nhat Hanh offers the words simply to say, I care about this suffering. And just those words can have an effect that can cultivate a shift. Another teacher, which I think Tara referenced, his phrases are, I'm sorry and I love you. Now for some of us, those techniques can be very powerful. And the more you practice them, the more the neurons begin to flow in that direction. For myself, and as I've worked with some people, I have a little more challenge in accessing self-compassion. It can be helpful to imagine that if a child or an animal was feeling as you're feeling, how might you nurture that if you were to sort of externalize? If your best friend in the world was feeling what you're feeling, how would you want to hold them? How would you offer compassion to them? One of the most powerful techniques I have found in my darkest, most challenging times, particularly when I'm grieving, is to remind myself this phrase. Other people feel this too. And for me, when I can remember that, it connects me to this human experience. And somehow something shifts where the frame gets bigger, that I can hold myself along with all those countless other people who are feeling this too. I find generating self-compassion is unique for each one of us. And if you find it's not easily accessible, it's very helpful to reflect on what aligns you, what gives you access to that juice of compassion, kindness, and joy. One way to think about the power of self-compassion: imagine that you're walking across your bedroom and you stub your toe on the corner of the bed. Option one, Number one, you swear. Number two, you swear again. Number three, you chastise yourself for being clumsy. Number four, you hobble on, try to ignore the pain, but you're spoiling for a fight. Option two, you stub your toe. One, you swear. Two, you sit down and you hold your foot in your hands. And three, you soften your hands and you feel what's going on. Four, you feel the pulsing, you feel the unpleasant sensation, and you just offer a sense of compassion. I care about this. You watch the sensations change a little bit, perhaps, and you carry on. When I think of those two options, which option will promote the healing of that toe more quickly? So I thought we might try on just a little bit of practice. If you like, you can close your eyes. And you might just deepen your breath. Maybe again, just revisit these three mindful breaths. How intimately can you feel the movement of the breath on the inside? And you might reflect back over this day or sometime over these last few days at a time of struggle, a time when you may have found yourself in resistance or caught in some form of judgment. And just take a few moments here to go through the files and select one specific memory, as specific as you can find. And as you reflect on this experience of dissatisfaction or stress or suffering, can you recall what it felt like inside? How intimately can you just sense how your body holds this memory? And we'll do a little experiment. Just exploring, if you were to hold this memory or this experience right now with a sense of self-compassion, how does it move? How does it shift? How does it change? And now, could you relax even more? And sense this quality of presence, whatever it may be for you. If you like, you can deepen your breath. And if you like, you can let your eyes open. There's something in this practice, however you find yourself wiring it up, to give it room to not mind it being there. Perhaps to put your hand to your heart or your cheek, to offer the words, "I care about this suffering." To imagine if another was feeling this, someone you cared about, what is the response? What is the quivering of the heart in response to that? Can you offer that to yourself? And to reflect that other people feel this too. A baby relaxes as it senses something holding her. some steady, benign presence as a backdrop into what your feelings can drop into. And when we can offer that for ourselves, we can sense this larger container, a sense of relaxation. Nice dramatic pause there. When we choose to open to compassion, it's interesting to reflect on these words from the Dalai Lama. He said, "We can let the circumstances of our lives harden us so that we become increasingly resentful and afraid, or we can let them soften us and make us kinder. You always have the choice." So when we choose this path of softening and opening, dramatic things can happen sometimes. I like to ask people, since you started practicing, how has your life changed? Some of the things they say, they might say, "I'm less reactive. I don't believe the negative self-talk quite as much. I'm more able to get another person's point of view when I'm in conflict." Someone said, "I can't tell exactly how, but I'm less tense." And someone said, "I have more confidence that I can be with anything." And I've noticed that for myself, all of them, but that last one in particular. And I find that becomes part of the practice. The more that you practice, the more you can recognize and realize what is here, to open to it, to move into it, to explore self-compassion, to find that which is so tightly held shifts. Your sense of self, your sense of identity gets more and more vast, more and more wide. There is indeed a sense of confidence that begins to emerge, that you can be with anything. So the two wings of our practice, the wing of wisdom, which is the capacity to see clearly, to see what is, to see through your story, your embellishments, your preferences, to what is real. And the wing of compassion, the capacity to bear it, to be with it, to hold it. And so our practice is informed by these two inquiries, the inquiry that is the seed of wisdom. What is happening right now? And the question that is the seed of compassion: can I be with it? Can I let this be? Or what is the attitude in my mind, as Hugh described it? So when you see more clearly, you begin to see into these qualities of reality, the three characteristics of reality. Have you noticed that everything is changing in your experience? Everything born out of causes and conditions is subject to change. This characteristic of anicca, of impermanence. Have you noticed that anything you try to control ends up creating some quality of dissatisfaction or stress? This is the characteristic of dukkha. Anything you're trying to control, anything you're trying to push away or hold on to, ultimately will lead to some quality of dissatisfaction, some quality of stress, or some quality of suffering. And have you noticed moments during this retreat where your experience just seemed to be happening by itself. And this points to this quality of anicca, this quality of not self. There is a relative self that is the product of causes and conditions, your character structure. And yet the more you relax and the more you pay attention, you might sense a quality of being, a quality of presence that requires no effort. It's the very air that we breathe. So in the face of all that changes, there is something that doesn't change. This quality of non-judging awareness, this quality of compassion or love. As Tara pointed to in our meditation this morning, that you are that awareness. You are that space. So we explored a little bit tonight of what gets in the way of being present. These mind states of resistance, the winds that pull you away, these seeds of greed and hatred and delusion. We explored a little bit of how concentration is a very helpful way of coming home, to bring yourself back to the experience of here and now, a very helpful tool. We've explored a little bit about the importance of self-compassion as the lubrication, as Sokni Rinpoche describes it. It's the lubrication that helps you let go of what you're holding on to. And however you find your way to access that, will deeply and profoundly inform your experience this week and through your whole life. So let's close with a meditation and a short reading. We'll close with a short reflection on the refuges. You may recall opening night, we chanted of the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, of awareness and truth and love. As you sense this quality of the Buddha, of wakefulness, can you imagine a limitless sky of being? Can you imagine the silence behind the sounds? Reflecting on the Dharma of what is true. What is the constellation of your experience right now? The felt sense, the body, the quality of mind, the quality of mood, this matrix of aliveness, thought, and feeling, seeing it in space, exactly as it is. Sensing this quality of Sangha, of this interconnectedness of our shared experience. Imagine, if you can, this experience suffused with compassion, with kindness, with love. A quality of effortlessness. Relaxed, at the same time, alert. And as you sense this quality of limitless space and limitless heart, acknowledging this shared human journey, reflecting on these words. After a while, you learn the subtle difference between holding a hand and chaining a soul. And you learn that love doesn't mean leaning, and company doesn't mean security. And you begin to learn that kisses aren't compromises and presents aren't promises. And you begin to accept your defeats with your head up and your eyes ahead, with the grace of a woman or man, not the grief of a child. And you learn to build all your loads on today, because tomorrow's grounds is too uncertain for plans, and futures have a way of falling down in mid-flight. After a while, you learn that even sunshine burns if you ask too much. And so you plant your own garden and decorate your own soul instead of waiting for someone to buy you flowers. And you learn that you really can endure, that you really are strong, and you really do have worth. And you learn, and you learn with every failure you learn. As we close with the three chimes of the meditation bell, you might sense the aliveness of sound and the space in which sound arises, is sustained, and falls away. Namaste.